Okay, we're picking up from last time where we kind of finished up with Abraham and his descendants, ultimately Isaac and Jacob and the 12 sons of Jacob becoming the heads of the 12 tribes of Israel. And of course, we know much of the rest of the story of their family. They were a relatively small family that ultimately relocated to Egypt during a famine because Jacob's son, Joseph, had been sold into slavery by his brothers and became the prime minister, essentially the prime minister of Egypt, and then the whole family ended up relocating to Egypt. So that's where they were for a few hundred years until really the whole Exodus experience, and that's what I wanted to focus on today, primarily the person of Moses. So the nation of Israel really changes under Moses dramatically. As we know, he's the author of the first five books of the Bible. He's a prophet, a priest, a type of king, a lawgiver, and a judge. And where Christianity and Messianic Judaism focus on Jesus or Yeshua, Judaism focuses on Moses, as he's referred to among the Jewish people, Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, our rabbi. So as the story goes, as we know, Moses leads the people out of Egypt. There's the plagues upon the Egyptians. They celebrate the Passover. They go through the Red Sea and so on. But really what's really central to the Jewish people and central to Judaism is the giving of the law. What happens with the giving of the law at Mount Sinai is that God grants the laws to Moses and the children of Israel, which is similar, actually, to other ancient Middle Eastern legal codes. For instance, there was a earlier legal code that is similar in nature, known as the Hammurabi Code, which is a Babylonian code, probably about 300 or 400 years older than the Mosaic Code. But what's different specifically about the laws of Moses is that they're God-centric. So what do I mean by that? Let's look in Deuteronomy chapter 17 to examine the centrality of God in the giving of the law. So we pick up in Deuteronomy 17, specifically in verse 18, it says this: "Now it shall come about, when he sits on the throne," that's the king, "of his kingdom, he shall write for himself a copy of the law on a scroll in the presence of the Levitical priests. It shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God by carefully observing all the words of this law and these statutes, that his heart may not be lifted up above his countrymen, and that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right or the left, so that he and his sons may continue long in his kingdom in the midst of Israel." So what's unique about the laws of Moses is that the king himself is subject to the law. That's completely unlike anything in the ancient world. In the ancient world, it was the king that issued the laws, and he always superseded the laws. So the king was not subject to the laws. But in the kingdom of Israel, under the Mosaic system, the king himself was subject to the laws of God. And so it's a very God-centric system. What's interesting is that you could say, in some ways, it's maybe similar to the more modern societies where leaders of countries are subject, at least theoretically, to the rule of law, especially in democracies, although that's not always the case, as we can see even in our own land here. But the point is that this is what makes the laws of Moses different and unique from the other surrounding nations. Now, what was in this law that was given to Moses? Well, basically, it's like any other legal code that a country lives by. So there were laws regarding families. There were laws, civil laws, that would cover what would happen in case there was, somebody was injured by another party and that they would be responsible for damages. There were criminal laws. There were laws regarding agriculture. There were commercial laws or military laws, foreign affairs, laws of foreign affairs. There was all kinds of very laws that covered every aspect of human existence. And so what was the purpose of these laws? Basically, these laws were to represent the character of God among his people. So what exactly do I mean by that? Let's look back to Exodus chapter 19, and where just before the law is given to Moses, and let's see what the Lord tells Moses on Mount Sinai just prior to the giving of the law. He says this beginning in verse 5. Now then, if you indeed will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words you are to speak to the sons of Israel. So in verse 6, the Lord says that Israel is to become a kingdom of priests. This is a continuation of the promise of God that he made to Abraham, where Abraham was with his calling and his descendants' calling were to be a blessing to all the nations. This was their chosenness. This was their purpose, was to be a blessing to the nations. And this is further defined here in Exodus 19, where God says specifically that Israel is to be a kingdom of priests. In other words, that a priest is one who stands between God and man. So Israel as a nation now stands between God and the rest of the nations of the world so that they become the representative of God to the nations. So how does this also happen? Well, he continues here in verse 6 where he says not only are they to be a kingdom of priests, but they are to be a holy nation. Now we know that the word holy, kadosh, means to be separate and apart. In other words, that the nation was to be separate and apart unto God. But how is that characterized? How is that defined? Basically, it's by keeping the law. In other words, these laws cause the nation of Israel to be separate and different from the rest of the nations of the world. So, for instance, their family laws were designed so that when the other nations would look at the families within Israel, they'd say, wow, why are your families so together, so wholesome? Or when they look at the civil laws and criminal laws, why is your system so fair and there's justice for all? Or when they look at the agricultural laws, why is your agriculture so prosperous? And then the children of Israel who've been keeping the laws can say, well, come and meet our God. In other words, it was a way of showing the character of God to the nations of the world by keeping all of these commandments. And so the Torah is given by God to the Jewish people for the purpose of reflecting the character of God to the nations. Now, according to the rabbis, there are actually 613 laws embodied within the Torah, the five books of Moses. However, as we get later into Talmudic times, the rabbis then take those 613 laws and then multiply them over many times so that you have thousands of permutations of laws that are contained in the Torah itself. But the actual written Torah, according to them, contains specifically 613 laws. And those laws are summarized in the giving of the Ten Commandments, which actually kind of inaugurates the giving of the law at Mount Sinai. And so let's specifically see how God grants the Torah to Moses and the children of Israel, because how he introduces it is critical to understanding how Jewish people are to understand the law. So we pick up in Exodus chapter 20, verse 1, it says, "And God spoke to all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me, and so on and so forth. Now, in Judaism, the first commandment of the Ten Commandments is actually the statement, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. In other words, that this is God's promise to them, and this is the first commandment. In Christianity, when the Ten Commandments are observed, it's usually the next commandment that's considered the first, which is that you shall have no other gods before me. So the idea here is in Judaism, the first commandment is what God has done for the people, rather as in Christianity, the first commandment is what the people are expected to do in response to what God has said. And this shows the difference of how Jews often observe the law versus Christians observing the law. In Judaism, the idea of the law was given as an act of grace. In other words, God delivered them from bondage in Egypt, out of slavery, and as a result of this deliverance, they are now to keep the laws of God. So for Jews, the idea of keeping the law is in response to the grace of God in his delivering power. It's very similar to what Yeshua himself said when he said, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. So for Jews, the idea is their obligation to keep the law is part of the covenant that they have with God in responding to his grace of chosenness, how he chose them and delivered them, and now in response to that, they are to keep his commandments. Now what's interesting about this is that it's the law that really ultimately defines who the Jewish people are. This is what makes the Jews unique in the world. This is what has kept them separate for essentially 3,500 years, and has also is this been this traditionally the source of persecution throughout most of their history. For example, we see this even a few times in the biblical period. We remember the story of Nebuchadnezzar, and he builds a statue to himself, and he expects everybody to bow down to a statue. As we recall, three Jewish men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, refuse to bow down, and consequently they're thrown into the fire. Why don't they bow down? Because of the laws of Moses. In other words, they are obeying what God said, and as a consequence, because they're not following the laws of the country in which they're living, they're persecuted. Of course, in Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's situation, they were delivered by the power of God from the fire. Another example is, of course, in the story of Mordechai, Esther, and Haman. Of course, Haman comes along, expects everybody to bow down to him. Mordechai, the Jew, refuses to bow down. Why? Because, again, you're not supposed to bow down to other people, considering them kind of divine figures. And so, as a consequence, all the Jewish people are persecuted because they're keeping the laws of God. And so this happens throughout all of Jewish history. You see it again in the Greek period, when during the period of the Maccabees, when Antiochus takes over the land of Israel and abolishes the laws of Moses, expects everybody to sacrifice to the gods of Zeus that are placed in the temple. Then you have the rebellion, the Maccabees rebel. They refuse to do that. Why? Why is the refusal? Why the persecution? Because they're trying to maintain their covenant with God by keeping the laws of God. This continues into the Roman Empire. It continues into Christianity as even Christianity persecutes Jews for keeping the law. And it continues up to this day, where Jews are often accused of being different, and they won't conform to the mainstream and everything. And this is because God has called them to be a different and unique people. And so this is the purpose of the law of God that was given to Moses. And for Jewish people, this is considered to be something very positive. In other words, the law is not negative. It's not a burden. It's a responsibility in response, a responsibility to keep God's covenant because of his choosing of them to be his representatives to the world. Now, also, it's also unique in how we understand this covenant that God made with the Jewish people is that in the ancient world, there were what was known as ancient suzerain covenant treaties. In other words, a suzerain is a type of king. And the idea of these treaties was that you would have a king that would come along and would conquer a people, and they would establish a treaty with these people. And so this treaty would contain a series of elements in it, which would include everything that the king did for them by delivering them from whatever other foreign power that they were subjected to. And now, as a response to everything that this king has done for them, they are to keep certain stipulations and commandments of this new kingdom. And so these particular treaties were always structured in certain ways. So, for example, all the treaties would contain the following types of elements. You would have an introduction, which would you would have an introduction of the treaty. Then you'd have a recitation of the historical relationship between the king and the people in which he just delivered. In other words, what happened in the relationship between the two. Then he'd have a list of stipulations or laws that they're expected to keep. Then he would have a listing of blessings and curses. In other words, if they followed his commandments, his laws, then good things would happen. And if they didn't, bad things would happen. Then there was an oath that would be taken by both parties. Then there was a succession clause, which is what happens when the current king passes. And then finally, there's what's called the final reading of the treaty, and then the placement of the replicas of the representatives of the treaty within a certain place, or so that both parties would have access to the treaty themselves. So what's interesting is that the book of Deuteronomy was structured after one of these ancient treaties, and these were called treaties of grace. In other words, the conquering king would see himself as doing an act of grace in delivering the people, and in response, the people would keep these treaty obligations. And so the book of Deuteronomy is structured in the way so that it's patterned after one of these ancient treaties. So, for instance, the introduction is in Deuteronomy chapter 1. The recitation of the historical relationship is in Deuteronomy's chapters 1 through 4. The stipulations or the laws are in Deuteronomy's chapters 5 through 26. The blessings and curses in Deuteronomy chapters 27 and 28. The oath, Deuteronomy 30. The succession clause, Deuteronomy 31. And then finally, in the same chapter 31, is the final reading and the placement of the replicas, placement of the law. Now, here's what's interesting, is that the Ten Commandments are the embodiment of the laws of Torah. They're the kind of the summary statement. And of course, we know that there's the two tablets that represent in which the Ten Commandments were written upon. Of course, in most of our the way we're taught, the way we usually understand it, is that there's five commandments on one tablet and five on another. But I think the reality is that there were probably 10 commandments on one tablet and 10 on the other. Why? Because each tablet was for one of the parties. So you had one tablet that was God's treaty responsibility, and the other tablet was the people's treaty responsibility. So they each had access to those two tablets in the one place where God and man met, which was in the tabernacle. So this gives us, again, a greater understanding of how the law becomes central to the Jewish people and how the Jewish people understand the law to this very day, so that we have a greater understanding. This is part of their covenant responsibility with God, that they're the chosen people of God. How are they chosen? Because they have this responsibility to keep the laws of God, to represent God's values to the nations of the earth. That is the purpose of the law and the importance of it, even into the modern era. Okay, so we're moving on from here now to the next step, because we know that Moses of course, perishes in the wilderness because of his disobedience. And now Joshua is raised up to bring the children of Israel into the land of Canaan. And there they're called to destroy all the Canaanite tribes, but they are to leave alone the tribes of Edom, Moab, and Ammon. And why is that the case? Because those three tribes, they're not Canaanite tribes, rather they are descendants of Abraham. And so consequently, they are under a protective covenant. They are not to be destroyed. And so Joshua then brings them in, and he becomes the leading figure. Now, through his leadership, most of the Canaanites are routed and destroyed, but not totally. And that becomes very, very important later on when we get to the New Testament period. And so here we're going to look at the map as they enter in to the promised land. And basically what ends up happening is that God promised each of the tribes of Israel certain territorial areas throughout Israel. And they are basically given responsibility by Joshua to go conquer certain areas. And so essentially what happens is that the nation becomes more of a collection of tribes as opposed to having like a national identity. And this is what's seen like during the period of the Judges, which lasts about 200 years. In the period of the Judges, you essentially have these various tribal groups that then are attacked by their enemies. And so a tribal leader arises who's known in the scriptures as a judge. And he often gathers together a few other tribal leaders from some of the other tribes, and they will try to fight off or defend their territory from aggression from abroad. And so that's essentially what goes on for a period of time, for those 200 years. And it's during this period that the primary opponents of the Israelite tribes are the Philistines, who essentially are a group of people who have migrated over from the land of Crete. Crete is in the Mediterranean, and they, according to the Bible, are actually descendants of Ham, Noah's son Ham, and they are not Palestinians. The Philistines and Palestinians are completely different people groups. Palestinians are Arab, and they are a Semitic tribe from the descendancy of Shem, but the Philistines are from a descendancy of Ham. And anyway, they inhabit like five cities along the coast, which include Ashdod, Ashkelon, Gaza, and a few other cities. And these are known as island people or sea people. So what happens is the people of Israel are getting tired of their enemies overrunning them, and they began to plead to God for a king, so that they will have a unified national identity instead of a tribal one. Interestingly, in Israel history, once the kingdom is established, which begins under David and continues for a few hundred years, is that you essentially have three groups in Israelite society that have authority by God in the society. Of course, most importantly, you have the king, who exercises executive leadership. He's involved in building programs and in leading military ventures. But you also have the prophets, whose responsibility is to call the people back to God. They are also reformers. They're calling for social equality and against injustice in society. And then you also have the priests, who are like the religious functionaries, but also function as a type of judiciary and teacher of the people, a teacher of the Torah. So these three groups of people basically constitute the leadership of ancient Israel, and often are kind of in conflict with one another about who's ruling whom. So you often see the prophets calling the kings into account, or the priests rising up in rebellion against the kings, or so forth, or whatever. But because Israel was a theocracy, no one ultimately had authority over the king to enforce any kind of law against him except for the Lord. And so God himself would bring judgment against the kings if for disobedience. So the beginning, first king, of course, we know is King Saul, and he becomes a failed king fairly early on. But then one of the most important figures, certainly the most important kingly figure, is King David. David becomes the preeminent king of all of Israel for all time. For those familiar with American history, he's like a George Washington figure. Or for modern Israel, modern Israeli history, maybe a figure like David Ben-Gurion, where all other kings, all other leaders are compared to that individual because of what he did. And so David is that type of person. He becomes the example for all kings thereafter, including the coming of the Messiah. The Messiah, which tends to be a later development in Judaism. In other words, yes, there's some what I call oblique references in the Torah to the coming of a messianic figure, but it's the idea of a Messiah coming is really more developed in the time of the prophets, and they typically compare the Messiah and the messianic kingdom to David and what he was able to achieve. Because what was he able to achieve? Basically, he made Israel become a regional power in the Middle East. And as we can see from this map right here, we can see that that the kingdom of David, first of all, he was able to unify the nation under all of his leadership. So all the tribes became under the kingdom of Israel, which was David's leadership. And then from there, he expanded the kingdom south and east and north so that it went all the way down into parts of the Sinai Peninsula, literally probably to the river of Egypt, and then all the way north, all the way up to present-day Iraq, to the Euphrates River, an amazing amount of territory at that time. So he leads them into this regional power, and so when the prophets talk about the Messianic kingdom, they're reflecting back on this period of time during David's reign and also during his son's reign, Solomon, where the nations would come up to Israel and they would be overwhelmed by its glory and everything else. And the Messiah is also supposed to do this idea where, again, the laws of Jerusalem come out from Zion and they go to the nations of the earth. From Isaiah. Again, it's kind of a picture of the Davidic kingdom. And then, of course, under Solomon, we know that he expands the kingdom further. He builds the temple, which becomes one of the wonders of the world, where God himself is present. He writes the Proverbs, Song of Solomon, Ecclesiastes. He's a great administrator and builder as he establishes prosperity throughout the land. But as we know, his heart starts to stray as he marries foreign wives and begins to follow idolatry. And God says that as a result, judgment will come upon him and his descendants because of his disobedience. So when he dies, his son Rehoboam takes over, but he is an unrighteous person. He doesn't follow the wisdom of the elders, and there's a group of, what we'd call rebels, primarily from the northern tribes of Israel, who provoke Rehoboam and say, under the leadership of Jeroboam, that they will not follow Rehoboam. They will not follow Rehoboam anymore, and they will establish their own kingdom. And they rebel. A civil war breaks out, and the northern tribes of Israel break away and establish their own kingdom, ultimately called Israel. And then the southern tribes, which are comprised of Judah and Benjamin, and also the Levites, become known as the Kingdom of Judah. So now you have two kingdoms, the northern tribes of the Kingdom of Israel and the southern tribes known as the Kingdom of Judah, and they tend to be at one another, not often warring against each other, but certainly competing against each other most of the time. Now, according to the Bible, all of Israel's, the northern tribes' kings are bad. In Judah, many of the kings are good, some are bad. But with the nation split now into two kingdoms, it's no longer the power that it was, and it's easy to take advantage of by other foreign empires, which they do. And so you see, beginning in the 800s, the rise of a new empire called Aram, which is today would be based in present-day Syria or Damascus. And this was the period of when prophets like Elijah and Elisha were prophesying. You also had Jonah, who ultimately went to the kingdom of Assyria, which we'll talk about in a minute. And then you have some really interesting passages in Isaiah chapter 7, which is a little bit further on now, because now we're looking in the 700s, as Isaiah describes what will happen to the northern tribes, what will happen to Aram, and what will happen to the kingdom of Judah. So let's pick up in Isaiah chapter 7. Isaiah 7, of course, is known most importantly for the virgin birth of the Messiah, but there's more to it than that. And so we're going to pick up in Isaiah chapter 7, verse 1. Now we're in the 700s, and it says this. Now it came about in the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah, that Razin, king of Aram, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, went up to Jerusalem to wage war against it, but it could not conquer it. So you can see what happened is there's an alliance here now between the kingdom of Aram, which is today present-day Syria, and the northern tribes of Israel against the kingdom of Judah, but they weren't able to conquer it. And so then it says, verse 2, when it was reported to the house of David, saying that the Arameans have camped in Ephraim, his heart and the hearts of his people shook as the trees of the forest shake with the wind. And then the Lord said to Isaiah, go out to meet Ahaz, so on and so forth. And then he says to him, verse 4, take care and be calm, have no fear, do not be faint-hearted because of these two stubs of smoldering firebrands, on account of the fierce anger of Razin and Aram and the son of Remaliah. Continuing on verse 8, for the head of Aram is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is Razin. Now within another 65 years, Ephraim, this is the northern tribes of Israel, will be scattered so that it is no longer a people. And the head of Aram, Ephraim is Samaria, and the head of Samaria is the son of Remaliah. If you will not believe it, you shall surely not last. So basically he's saying this. Look, he's saying this alliance against the kingdom of Judah, it's not going to work. And the reality is that the kingdom of Israel will be destroyed. They'll be scattered throughout the nations within the next 65-year period. And so you're not going to have to worry about them any longer. That was the essential promise. And then he goes on to say later how this is going to happen. So he says in verse 17, the Lord will bring on you, on your people, and on your father's house such days as has never come since the day that Ephraim separated from Judah, the king of Assyria. That means he's coming. In that day, the Lord will whistle for the fly that is in the remotest parts of the rivers of Egypt and for the bee that is in the land of Assyria, and they will all come and settle on the steep ravines, on the ledges of the cliffs, and all the thorn branches, and on all the watering places, and so on. And so in other words, what the Lord's saying here is that another kingdom is going to arise that's called the kingdom of Assyria that is going to come and bring judgment first and foremost upon the kingdom of Aram, and then will attack and defeat and destroy the kingdom of Israel. So in the year 735, the kingdom of Aram is overrun by the kingdom of Assyria. And then in the year 722, the kingdom of Assyria attacks the northern tribes, and in 714 defeats them and then scatters them to the nations, scatters them throughout the Assyrian Empire. And you can see on the map here, this is the Assyrian Empire. It goes throughout the Middle East, And so the northern tribes are then spread throughout the Assyrian Empire. It describes, in Isaiah 10, it describes Assyria as being the rod of God's anger against the northern tribes. And so, in other words, this shows how God uses nations in history for his purposes. God uses an unrighteous and ungodly nation to bring about judgment upon the nation of Israel because of her ungodliness. And if you remember from the first session that we gave, is that when we talked about when we understand history, about God, how God is involved in human history, even not with respect to the Jewish people, here we see that God uses Assyria to bring judgment upon the nation of Israel. Why? Because they disobeyed the Lord. Israel and the Jewish people were placed in the land of Israel to be his representatives. But as God said, if they are no longer representing him adequately, he will bring judgment upon them and remove them and send them into the nations until he restores them later. And this is exactly what happens. Judgment is brought upon them. They are spread throughout the empire of Assyria. And this becomes known in history, this group, as the 10 lost tribes of Israel. And what's so fascinating about it is that these 10 lost tribes of Israel, everybody always claims that they're part of the 10 lost tribes of Israel. So even down to the modern day, you see people claiming to be from the 10 lost tribes of Israel. So for example, the for those of you familiar with the there's a group of Jews or a group from India that claims to be descendants of the tribe of Manasseh, and so they claim to be from these descendants. And then there's other groups that claim also connection to the lost tribes of Israel. For instance, for those of you that are familiar with Mormonism and Mormons, they claim to be of the 10 lost tribes of Israel. And that throughout history, everybody's always looking for these 10 lost tribes and so on and so forth. I do believe, however, that God will bring back these 10 lost tribes and reunite them with Judah. And why do I say that? Because it says that in Ezekiel chapter 37. Ezekiel 37 is best known for, it's for the prophecy of the dry bones coming to life, which is kind of the promise of the restoration of the modern state of Israel. But there's also a promise about the restoration of the 10 lost tribes. And let's take a look. It says, Ezekiel 37:15, "The word of the Lord came to me, saying, 'And you, son of man, take for yourself one stick and write on it, for Judah and for the sons of Israel, his companions. Then take another stick and write on it, for Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, and all the house of Israel, his companions. Then join them for yourself, one to another, into one stick, that they may become one in your land. When the sons of your people speak to you, saying, "Will you not declare to us what do you mean by these?" Say to them, "Thus says the Lord God, behold, I will take the stick of Joseph, which is in the hand of Ephraim, and the tribes of Israel, his companions, and I will put them with it, with the stick of Judah, and make them one stick, and they will be one in my hand." And then it goes on to say that David will take over. Now, Ephraim is often referred to as the leader of the northern tribes. So in other words, God is bringing back the northern tribes, the sons of Joseph, with the sons of Judah, bringing them back and making them one. That's the promise of God. So I believe that in the end times, that the Lord is and will bring back the lost tribes of Israel, the 10 lost tribes of Israel, and that they will reunite. And there certainly is some evidence of that, even in our modern era. There's been some books written on it by some rabbis who have found kind of vestiges of old Israelite beliefs or Jewish beliefs from way in the past in some of these people groups around the world that are likely vestiges of the 10 lost tribes. And so God is bringing them back and has brought them back. to the land of Israel as he has promised to fulfill his word. And with that, we will close for today. Thank you.